Welcome to the official Robcast podcast. I'm your host, Rob, and this is my podcast. Hello in podcast land. That was me singing. If you're listening to this in the morning, then I'm singing in the morning. If you're listening to this, etc., etc. So, what is podcast land? Why do they call them podcasts? I'm sure somebody's already asked this. Somebody who may actually know more about the history of radio. Oh, broadcast? Is it a play on broadcast? So, if you were to have, say, was there a television show called Broadcast News? Or maybe was that a movie? Could you make something called Podcast News? Today in Podcast News. And then obviously, Robcast is a play on words of podcast, which is a play on words of broadcast, which is twice removed. I've got this theory, and I don't know if it's accurate. Well, theory. It's a theory. I think that just explains where it's at. That in order for something to be funny, to me at least, it needs to have at least two links of separation from it. And I think it's because I appreciate puzzles and the challenge of wordplay or riddles or figuring something out. And therefore, not only is something funny, but half of the reason why I laugh sometimes is because I'm rewarding myself for understanding a clever joke, right? It's when people, they put out some obscure movie reference and then they're looking around and they're like, who gets what I'm talking about? And literally, you know, maybe they bond over. I was just reading a dear friend of mine, his wife-to-be wrote how they met. And their first date, they bonded over this really specific song. I can't remember what it is now. I probably can't remember because I'd never heard of it, but I thought, wow, what luck, you know, that they both know this obscure song. They both probably understand it's obscure, and they both feel the same way about the song, right? That must help connect them, or maybe give them a sign from God that they're on the right path. I think a lot of people look for signs outside of themselves, right? They, if they're in despair or, I mean, that's what praying is, isn't it? It's like what Jenny does in Forrest Gump. She goes, "Dear God, make me a bird so I can fly far, far, far away. Dear God, make me a bird." And God must have answered his prayer. I can't remember the exact quote, but essentially Jenny got away from her abusive father and home life from the farm and went on an adventure that lasted a lifetime. Well, I guess all adventures last a lifetime, because a lifetime is simply a marking of between when someone's born and when someone dies. Excuse me while I sip some coffee. I just got this Burr coffee grinder. And for those of you who are, I was going to say coffee snobs, but I feel like that's a snobby thing to say. And then that umming was me trying to think of a two-link separation pun where I could incorporate Rob and Snob. Snobcast? No, the Snobcast podcast. But it's this burr grinder, and I don't actually know how it works precisely. I just know that there's not a... I think it's more of a conical blade as opposed to a flat blade, like that's in your Mr. Coffee, you know, electric coffee grinder. And this is not an electric grinder. This is a hand crank grinder. So it, I don't know if it's more rewarding because I feel like I'm putting more work into it and therefore the coffee tastes better. It's interesting, right? Because my friend, well, actually I know two people who have this particular coffee maker, and I've heard it billed as the Mercedes of coffee makers. It's called the Mocha Master, and essentially you let it do all the work. You know, it grinds it, it pours it, it does this, it does that. It's an amazing machine, right? But do I feel more satisfied from my cup of coffee because I have put some of the work into it? Now, the method that I have now is I have whole coffee beans. I put them in the burr grinder and I grind it myself. And, you know, it's resistant. It's resistant until it's not. And that's how you can tell when it's done. And you pour it in the little filter and you pour hot water over it, but you can't pour it all at once. You have to pour it and just heat it up so it blooms. It'll puff up so the coffee blooms and the oils and the flavors seep out of there and into the vessel in which it collects the liquid. And then you keep doing it. And the pour-over method really is an exercise in patience, you know. You pour it over, and then you stop. You have to wait for a few minutes, and then you pour it over again. I mean, I think it is, you know, besides me roasting my own beans, growing my own coffee, harvesting it, it's the closest that I've been to being involved in the process. And so I wonder, does that make me appreciate it more? I think we've talked about this before, but maybe we haven't. There was a study in the 1950s. They did a lot of focus groups. They did a lot of focus groups with housewives. Now, as we know, in the typical nuclear family of the 1950s, the husband earned the bacon, or bought the bacon? No. What's the word? Brought home the bacon. He earned the bread, brought home the bacon, made the cheese, and she made the delicious sandwich out of it. No. And that's a lot of lettuce. So, sorry, I didn't mean to put so much mustard on that joke. Oh my goodness, I can't stop. I'm getting caraway'd. Okay. All right. I have to focus. Thank you. So they had these... Oh, focus. That's the word I meant to say. Anyway, they had these focus groups. And what they found out... I think this was for Betty Crocker company. They had these instant cake mixes. And women weren't buying them, even though it was so much easier to make these cakes. All they had to do was, you know, add a few ingredients, pour in water or something, mix it up and put it in the oven, and It looked like they'd been baking all day, but really they could be reading Better Homes and Gardens or watching As the World Turns or any number of other things that women did in the 1950s, which are less stereotypical than what I just suggested. So these women, as it turns out, felt guilty that they weren't more involved with the process. So the advertising agency, I believe this was all Edward Bernays. He's, if you haven't heard about him, he's fascinating. He's certainly been the psychological architect for advertisements in the United States for decades and decades, and his methods are still used, and it's the reason why things are marketed to us in a psychological way that we feel like we want them as opposed to we need them. So, or they make us feel like the things that we actually want are necessities as opposed to desires. So they deduced that if you make the housewives feel a little more involved with what they're doing, then they won't feel as guilty, then they'll feel like they're part of the whole. So they said, crack an egg into it. Now, you don't need an egg. That's the thing. You don't need to put an egg into the baking mix, but they said, crack an egg into it. And the women cracked the egg into it, and it made them feel included. It made them feel like they were part of the whole. So what happened? That was my gesture of my finger going up, and probably the stocks going up for Betty Crocker, and the sales going up, and the cake mix is flying off the shelves, and everyone was eating Betty Crocker, and everyone loved it, and everyone let them all eat cake, as Marie Antoinette, the famous baker, once said. Marie Antoinette was interesting. She lived this sort of fantasy life. She created this own fantasy life for herself, where she was like the milkmaid or something, like she would tend to the sheep, the shepherdess, and she lived as what she thought of as a normal person. But the difference between that and her actually living like a normal person is like some sort of Trustafarian buying a Jeep from the 1970s and driving it around as their beater car, when they can afford a Maserati. It's not the same. She may have tricked herself, but the difference is there's no risk in what she did. There's no there's nothing driving her to sustain that life, because she could leave it at any time. It's just a fantasy for her. It's not real. There is no real stakes, so to speak. So that brings us to what drives us. And let's think about this for a second. Let's talk about, well, first let's talk about passion, right? We've said a few things. Baking can be a passion. Marie Antoinette's fantasy life is certainly a passion. Jokes, we just mentioned jokes, those can be a passion. People dedicate their entire lives to jokes. Comedy writers, comedians, people that were on the vaudeville circuit, court jesters back in the day, clowns, and I don't mean the creepy kind that Tim Curry, I've got chlorophobia, and so I have to stop talking about the C word right now. Oh my goodness. I feel it, it's like, I often feel like how people that are afraid of dogs seem to be magnetized to them. They seem to attract the dogs, and people say, well, you're attracting, they can sense your fear. I feel the same way about clowns. I can't tell you how many times, just randomly, I've been in a situation where clowns have just come up to me and nobody else, just me, and just sort of hung around me or stared at me from a distance or penetrated my dreams and chased me down. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times. And maybe it just sticks out more for me because I have a fear of clowns. But I mean, honestly, oh, I said it again. Honestly, it's interesting. I feel like I am being honest, but then why do I say honestly? Is it because I'm going deeper down another level, a layer, revealing something about myself, revealing something vulnerable that someone could use against me if they wanted to? I guess if you wanted to track me down and psychologically terrify me with clown paraphernalia or dress up like a clown, or I don't know. Anyway, I don't mean to keep talking about this. I feel like it's a void that I can't help being sucked into. What is that? It's a fascination with fear. And what did Milan Kundera said something interesting about vertigo, and I'll be butchering it terribly. He said, you know, what is vertigo? Is it the fear of falling? No, it is not the fear of falling. It is the simultaneous desire to jump and the fear of falling, like while you're at the precipice of that void, and what drives you to it, right? So in a way, I think he's saying that there's two parts to fear. There's fear and there's desire, because part of us are curious about that fear. I mean, that's why there's horror movies. That's why there's haunted hayrides and haunted houses, and people really like being scared that way. But just like Marie Antoinette, just like Marie Antoinette. Oh no, that's the song goes, just like Romeo and Juliet. I can't remember who sang. Is that Bryan Adams? No. Anyway, it's not real, right? And the whole thing that we try to do is to create an experience that feels real but isn't real. Or if we're really good at it, we create an experience that psychologically happens within our own mind, not just tactily outside of ourselves. Like, I think, you know, I mean, that's why I think there is this huge culture of psychedelic drugs happening in the 1960s. People wanted to escape the drab life. They knew there was something more. They wanted to travel. But a lot of these people lived in suburban basements. They couldn't get to the Andes or the Himalayas or to outer space, or, you know, it was boring. There was, you know, just wheat growing outside on the farm or whatever you have it. I mean, there's some sort of desire to want to escape into a place, or to understand the world or the universe in a different way, or to feel more connected, or just to feel something, right? And that's what these psychedelic drugs did. They, in a way, connected us as humanity. I mean, there's still ancient cultures in the Andes or the jungles of South America, in these places that will have shamans guide you through an ayahuasca treatment. I don't know if treatment is the right word, but, you know, it's an experience, right? So we've got these. That's why, like, in Topanga, there's the Church of the Ayahuasca, and people do this sometimes monthly, you know, to to search, to get out of their drab lives, whatever it is. I mean, there's a lot of, like, you know, I know a lot of people that have been doing this, and then a lot of people say, yeah, sure, I'll do it, and then they come back and they're like, yeah, it's life-changing, but then they come back and their life actually doesn't change. It's just their own perspective. Like, for instance, what I mean by this is they still have the same problems, they still have the same issues, they don't actually take action towards anything. Their reality has just shifted a bit and expanded or contracted or whatever it is, just, you know, moved in some way. And I'm not exactly sure. Well, I've never done it, so I can't attest to, you know, life before and after ayahuasca, but any of these things, right? So I went to see this incredible production, and it's traveling now, so if it comes to your city, I would certainly check out The Encounter. It's Teatro Complicité's new show. It's a one-man show with Simon McBurney, but he's actually recounting essentially retelling a book of a anthropologist whose name I can't remember, last name McIntyre, and he is encountering a indigenous tribe in the jungle of South America for the first time. I don't think they've ever met anyone Western, and so it's this whole sort of, you know, story that happens. But the very interesting thing is everyone in the audience gets a pair of headphones, and this performer on the stage has this, there's this head which is called a binaural microphone, and it essentially acts as the sound field for recreating whether or not somebody is to the right of us, behind us, in front of us. You know, it's a 360 degree sound stage. So when we hear, so when he's walking around that head, we actually hear him on the right hand side in our ear. And like, if he blows into the microphone in the right ear of this head, it blows right into our right ear. And it's a very, you know, intimate and disturbing thing that happens, and it happens to the entire audience, and that's just one of the things. So I guess what my ulterior point is, I keep wanting to say exterior point, my interior point is that, and it is an interior point, that we create it. We create this performance, because it's a combination of what is going on in our mind. This voice is now in our head, right? So it almost seeps in and becomes part of our underconscious, the unconscious or subconscious or whatever you want to call it. What? Somebody told me that Irish people, they put the wind in the words when they have a WH. What? When? Where? I always thought that was an interesting visual, because it can get windy in Ireland. So you've got this performance, and then the guy sort of recreates this experience where the tribe, they like make him drink from this this vine tea, which turns out to be ayahuasca, and you know, the background just subtly shifts, and you wonder, did I see that or did I make that up in my mind? And it's this kind of weird thing where you're not sure if you're slipping from reality, but the whole point of it is that it is not really happening. I mean, that is not happening in our mind, it's happening outside of our mind. It's just that it feels like it's happening in our mind, because at that point we are so on the interior, and we are the ones that are driving this experience. He's simply the vessel that we feel like we're going on the experience with him. And I think that's why, you know, people are becoming fascinated with immersive theater, site-specific immersive theater, because it's just one step closer to becoming the reality. Now, obviously, with technology going the way that it's going, virtual reality is going to be the next big thing. And I think that people who recreate these experiences with, I mean, think about if you were in a movie, literally in the movie, you were one of the characters in the movie, and people were coming up to you, talking to you as if you were the movie. Now, the only difference is, can you interact? Is it a scripted, you know, it's almost like, what is it? Westworld, right? Yeah, on HBO. Like, these are robots, and there's a story that's told. Nothing's real. It feels so real. Now, we take a look at that, and it's actually a separation of a separation. And you know that you can tell that they do a really great job, and that's why they've got such amazing actors as, Anthony Hopkins and, what's his name? The fella who was in Angels in America. Because they're actors portraying people inside of a artificial world. So it's removed, and yet we're right along there with them because it's flawless. The editing, the sound design, the effects, it puts us in that place. It's interesting. We don't need to do much, right, as the receiver of this. Now, the interesting thing is what goes into that. I'm sure part of it is fun, but I'm sure part of it is grueling to create these things. And it's work. It's just as much work as the CPA who's going over the taxes for, the small business owner and making sure to get them in before the deadline. It's just as much work as anything. So we're talking about creative work. Well, creativity, as we know, people say that, they use words like inspired or motivated or I had this epiphany and I had to write it down or whatever it is. But I think most of the time when we're talking about very creative people, and I don't want to use this as a blanket statement, but if it warms you up, then let it be. It's just one of these things that when you see the final result, it feels effortless. But the work that goes into it, for instance, someone writing the Great American Novel, I mean, how much work really goes into that? And then, or a musician, right? So what do you do when you spend 10 years on your debut album and then you feel dried up, you feel uninspired? Well, I think a lot of musicians, and maybe even beforehand they did this, they turned to drugs because, you know, they feel like, I don't know if it's a shortcut or it's just a compressed version of life experience or what have you. If it's just gets them out of their own head so that they can find creativity. So there's all sorts of, you know, ways to get inspiration. I mean, they can't necessarily live 10 years and then come back and write their next album because commercially they'd be irrelevant. Some people do that. I mean, there are some authors that have gone What? The woman who wrote Gilead, I mean, she wrote Housekeeping, and then 20-some years later, when everyone just kind of dismissed her as a one-hit wonder, she won the Pulitzer Prize with Gilead. So it's like, you know, I mean, there are people who can go out of the limelight so far removed from society and then come back, and it's as if they never left. But that doesn't always happen. And more importantly, you can't sustain yourself from that. So if it's any sort of creative medium, a writer, an actor, a director, you have to keep working. So what do you do when you don't feel inspired? You have to keep at it. I mean, that's the thing. It's you provide yourself no other option. Now, it's a passion, right? I think we've thrown that word around. Well, what does passion mean? Passion, I think, is simply a positive reinforcement for something that drives us to do something. And it's a touchstone that we can keep going back to, a well that we can keep replenishing our own selves, you know, an oasis in the middle of the desert, whatever you want to call it. It's something that that fills us up so that we can complete a task, right? Some people are very passionate about cleaning. I mean, I know these kinds of people. Some people are passionate about cooking. Some people are passionate about, you know, being an electrician, whatever. Some people are passionate about politics. Some people are passionate about reading, you know, comic books. Whatever it is, there are passions that people have. And I think it's something that's interesting because what happens when you commit yourself to, say, you know, writing screenplays, and you start with a great passion for it, and you kind of dry up? Well, you've got deadlines, and you still need to finish that screenplay. It becomes work, right? I mean, work is kind of categorized, at least psychologically for me, it's categorized as something that you're obligated to do in order to achieve something, or in order to get some sort of outcome from it, right? We have a job so that we can get money, so that we can support ourselves and our families, et cetera, so that we can feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and water ourselves and all that stuff. Well, when passion dries up, where do we turn? We turn to nose to the grindstone. Some people call it grit. There's this great book. Actually, I don't know if it's great yet. I just got it. I just received it as a grit gift. It's by Angela Duckworth, and it's called The Power of Passion and Power in Perseverance. Is that what it's called? Oh, wait. It's called The Power of... No. Oh, I said power twice. It's called The... Oh, I think it's just called The Power of Passion and Perseverance. So, sorry for those long pauses, but it was kind of nice to take a pause, because I feel like I'm talking faster than I normally do. Interestingly enough, I was panicking when I was pausing, because I thought, oh, I'm not entertaining right now. I'm not doing anything. It's just silent. Let's experiment with that. Let me just be silent. See how long I can go before I get anxious. Yeah, I'm getting anxious. It's I see the counter going, I see the red bar continuing, and then I see there's no sound waves, and it's, you know, I'm flashing ahead to people listening to it. They go, oh, did something happen? Is the stream gone? Yeah. Anyway, grit is what a lot of successful creative people have. For instance, it's just, it's not enough to have talent to take you through with passion. Michael Jordan was probably, arguably, one of the most talented basketball players of all time, but he had grit. He practiced and practiced and practiced what he did. He kept working at it. He was resilient. He worked through his own failures. He succeeded because he failed so many times. What is that old saying that successful people fail more times than you've even tried? That's what makes them successful. So what does that mean? Is it a numbers game? Is it a is it simply getting back on the horse and riding it? Is it trying not to let failure affect you, or shifting it so that it doesn't even feel like failure, or stagnant, or going backwards, or whatever, you know, whatever you're thinking of for yourself. It's resiliency and dedication to what you are doing. For instance, this is now my 28th podcast here. I haven't been doing them for a while, but I did jump into it. I think I've done about 10 in a row every week. So what drives me to do that? Is it because I'm accountable to myself, to my public? Is it because if I fall off, then I won't be relevant anymore? Is it because I want to prove to myself that I can do something ritualistically and not just habitually, so that I, by choice, create something somewhat of a habit, or a I'm not sure what another word for it is, but do you catch my drift? That's another idiom that I don't understand what it means. Like, what is a drift, and how do you catch a drift? Is a drift wind, and catching it, does it catch it in the sails? Is that what it is? I don't know. But we look at these things and we go, okay, how is this comedian so funny? How is this actor so good? Well, you know, there's this theory that it takes 10,000 hours to be a master at what you're doing, right? They make you go through 10,000 hours of flight training, apparently, before you become some sort of commercial pilot. I think that's true. I'm not sure. I may have been making that up. There's a theory, and I kind of agree with the theory, because the more time you spend doing something, the better you get at it. For instance, Stephen Adler Gierges was an actor, and then he became a playwright. He started writing plays. I took a workshop of his some time ago. I can't remember, you know, the whole point of it, but it was like, you know, about writing, and I remember he said, you know, if you're, you know, the way that you write, the person who sits down the longest, they're the writers. And he's right. And this is a man that just won the Pulitzer Prize for Between Riverside and Crazy, which is a huge accomplishment. He had some plays on Broadway, and he's become a very successful playwright. Humble, no ego, you know, but this is something that can be learned. he learned to sit down for extended periods of time, write what he had within him, perhaps inspired by life around him or his personal history or whatever it may be. But these were things that were learned. Now, was his resiliency learned? Was his work ethic learned? Yeah, maybe. You know, what's driving him to do it? What's holding him accountable? What holds successful people accountable at that high level? They don't give themselves an option, right? If someone really wants to improve their health or their body, you don't give yourself the option of not going to the gym at 5 in the morning. You just say, that's what I do. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to go to the gym and I'm going to... It's the easiest thing to do physically, like, you know, to start working out. All you're really doing is lifting weight or walking in place or whatever it is. It doesn't take a lot of brain power, but we are so resistant to it, especially in this culture. I feel maybe in Los Angeles it's a little bit different because there's a sense of healthiness here, a lot of juice bars, you know, but it's still very difficult for people to feel motivated to do these things. Well, you just have to figure out deep down what is driving you. Why do you turn the keys to that particular engine and start that up? What is it about it? You know? And I don't know if knowing why helps or if it's just an intrinsic thing, but I think I've heard this again and again that, you know, people don't really have a choice. I'll ask successful actors, I go, well, you know, why are you doing this? They go, well, I don't really have a choice. I'm terrible at everything else. They'll say that. Now, that may just be a way of skirting the issue or, you know, of not wanting to answer that question because it's such a question that people ask, and it's like, oh, geez, you know, why are you asking this question? What does it matter? But at the same time, I do believe that all of this resiliency, all of this perseverance, all of this, this drive, so to speak, is simply a side effect of doing what you are passionate about or what you are meant to do or what you have to do or what you want to do, right? I mean, people may not like hard work, but hard work is the side effect for wanting to provide for your family, for wanting to put food on the table. In this society, we look at working hard as, as satisfactory. And it probably goes back to sort of agricultural days when people were really tactily, they were tilling the soil and people were doing things that really required a lot of physical labor and then later a lot of sort of mental labor, which is why there's a lot of stigma around being in the arts and saying, oh, yeah, you know, a lot of people who do other things, they go, that's not work. That's, you know, how hard is it to pretend to be somebody? Well, you know, I can't attest to anybody else, but for me, as an artist, I'm constantly trying to learn more things and trying to be more skillful and trying to, expand my knowledge base and work at my craft and my technique and my talent, you know, which I think are things that you can work on. I think that if you think about it, a little bit redundant there, but if you think about it, I had something I was going to say, but now I forget. Anyway, my point is that if we can figure out what's driving us, then we can work towards a life that we want to live. And I don't mean that in a motivational way. I just mean, hey, we've got choices. So let's know that and let's use them. And I think that's it for today.
Well, that's all the time we have today at Robcast Podcast. Be sure to tune in every week to find the latest Robcast podcast at officialrobcast.podomatic.com. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at officialrobcast. Thanks so much for listening. Stay alive.